Good morning and welcome. Today, Tales of the Sierra Madre into the lawless heart of contemporary Mexico. A debate about the future of oil. Do the price rises actually increase world reserves dramatically?
Stay with RTE Radio 1.
Yesterday, Ryanair announced that it would only break even this coming year due to rising fuel prices. Last week, our fishermen handed out free fish in a protest about their rising fuel prices. They say it'll put them out of business. Our school bus drivers say they cannot afford to continue to deliver the service, and truck drivers warn of protests and demonstrations yet to come. But the question is, are we witnessing a short-term price bubble, or is it finally, this time, the beginning of the end of the oil era? I'm joined in studio by Tony Allwright, Irish Times columnist and retired oil industry engineer, and on the telephone from West Cork by Colin Campbell, retired British petroleum geologist and founder of the Association for the Study of Peak Oil and Gas. So good morning to you both. Tony, first of all, what is your view as to what is happening at the moment? I mean, is this price inevitably going to continue rising because oil is becoming much more short in supply?
It's not so much becoming short in supply as the demand is shooting up and has been for the last few days, a few years, from a combination of unprecedented economic growth in the rich West, rapid industrialization of India and China, and at the same time fears about supply risks because of political problems in Iraq and Iran and so forth. And these things have conspired to certainly to put pressure on oil supplies, and that's in the classic behavior of markets, has shoved the price up and up and up.
Now, do you think it's going to continue to go up?
It's quite possible that it could go up further, but it's not going to go up forever, because as the price goes up, inevitably consumption goes down. People do cut back on their consumption simply because it's too damned expensive.
And start doing things like we hear about General Motors, who are going to abandon their Hummer production. They're going to become less the company of the SUV and more the company of the subcompact. They're talking about electric cars. We're all going to insulate our houses better. So the demand for oil is going to, do you think, plateau?
Well, the demand is not going to rise at the rate it has been rising. There's no doubt about that in my mind, because it isn't just people becoming more efficient. It's also businesses, oil-hungry businesses, going out of business in many cases. And across the board, anything that reduces the cost of your energy is going to become more attractive, and vice versa. And that's just the demand side of the equation. But then there's the supply side of the equation. And you can imagine that if 10 years ago you expected to get $20, $30 for a barrel of oil, and now you can get $130, you have a huge incentive to produce more and more of that oil by whatever means. And this creates tremendous pressure to develop oil that previously was uneconomic, to develop new technologies that lets you go after the more difficult oil that formerly would be ignored.
So what kind of things have geologists and petroleum engineers just not bothered with before because it was too expensive to extract?
Well, offshore oil, for example. To drill a typical exploration well onshore might cost between $1 and $10 million. The same well offshore, you're talking about $100 million plus. Now, clearly, if you have a choice between drilling the $10 million well or the $100 million, you will, of course, go after the $10 million well. But if, in the meantime, the price of your product has increased by a factor of, 7 or 8, suddenly the $100 million a barrel investment can look attractive again.
So even though you're not making as much money as someone producing from the sands of Saudi Arabia, you're still making a profit, and whether that profit is, in your case, say 20% compared to the Saudis' 1,000%, so be it. You're still making money.
Saudi oil is still most of it produced around $10 a barrel or so, and okay, they made money when the oil price was $15, and they're making money like hell at $135. But if you can produce oil that costs you maybe $70 a barrel now, you can also make money. Not in comparison what the Saudis make,
but you're still making
a damn good return, yes. Yeah. But the problem is there's a long lead time between when you decide to increase your production, whether it's for exploration or developing known prospects, so, and actually getting your hands on the oil, there can be a 10-year time lapse.
But is it also likely that the Saudis, for example, when they see what's happening, or the Iraqis who are sitting on massive, easily accessible reservoirs of oil, they'll say, hang on a second, these guys can take oil out of the most ridiculous places and maybe flood the market with oil at that price. We've got to pull the price back down to make sure these guys don't get going.
Well, that certainly happened after the 1970s. There was fear of too much non-OPEC oil being produced, is exactly what happened. I mean, the OPEC embargoes of the 1970s more or less invented North Sea oil. They wouldn't... And it was
it made North Sea oil viable.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, what about the alternative technologies, the wind, the wave technologies, which are on the cusp of viability at prices of $70 or $80 a barrel? At $130 a barrel, they're more than viable, aren't they?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it isn't... When a high oil price doesn't just suck in more oil to meet the demand, it makes previously uneconomic energy sources suddenly economic. A couple of years ago, The Economist put out a table and they said, well, biodiesel is economic at $80 a barrel, ethanol at $60, shale oils at $70 a barrel. That was at the time, I think, when the oil price was around about $70 or $80. Yeah. Well, all these things...
So they were on the cusp of viability at that point.
Without getting out of bed in the morning, these technologies have suddenly become economic in a way that they weren't a few years ago.
All right, and the final point I'll put to you before going to Colin is the question of, you know, we're told all the big reservoirs of oil have been found. They're historical, they're now depleting. You would argue no?
Well, I would argue the common sense says there's absolutely a correct expectation that the big oil fields have been found. Why? Because you see them on seismic, these massive structures. You can always find it's the small structures that are hard to see, but the big ones you can see, so therefore they've been found. But I would be wrong. Earlier this year, there was a report, I think, of the previous year, that Petrobras in Brazil made three massive supergiant discoveries. A supergiant field is one that is greater than 500 million barrels. So there were three of them. They're called Carioca, Sugarloaf, Tupi and Jupiter, all offshore Brazil in deep water, very difficult and expensive technologically to get out.
But it's
ground.
There.
48 billion barrels they're talking about. That's 5% of estimated world reserves. So these massive, these super giants apparently are still being found. It's quite astonishing.
All right, Colin, peak oil we have talked about. Maybe we're not as close to it or even beyond it as you have suggested.
No, I think the numbers still confirm that we are more or less at the halfway point. I mean, there's a great debate going on whether it's this year, next year, 5 years out, and I think this in a way misses the point. What matters really is the vision of the long decline that comes into sight on the other side of it.
Now, the question of price and supply and demand economics, because that's really where we're at the moment. If the price becomes too high, I mentioned General Motors, they're saying we're going to produce small cars, electric cars. I mean, that alone, if that became the trend in the US motor industry, would dramatically decrease their demand, wouldn't it?
Absolutely, and I agree with you that if there's a world recession of some kind that seems to be building right now, with the banks going bad and debt going bad and this subprime problem and everything else, if there is a recession or even a depression, then the demand for oil would fall, and with it the price. So I think we do face a volatile future, but the overall direction, I mean, the simple way to put it is we enter the second half of the age of oil.
Yeah, so it's not that you are wrong in any sense, it's just that it may be deferred slightly.
I don't think I'm wrong. Well, first of all, the fact that there is a peak, I think, is beyond dispute. After all, it's a finite resource formed in the geological past. It means it starts and ends and reaches a peak in between. So that part of the argument is I think, beyond dispute, and I think now widely accepted. As you say, the exact date and the exact rate of decline can't be accurately predicted, but it is some kind of important turning point for the world, because we've lived in this epoch of growth over the last 150 years, fueled by cheap oil, and now we're probably facing the second half of the age of oil when this stuff declines. Exactly what's going to happen, nobody knows.
The challenges that are posed by peak oil and the fact that oil will be available for still a long time, but probably increasingly expensively and at what rate, as you say, is unpredictable. But it may give rise to such fundamental changes in the way we design our houses, the way we heat our houses, the way we ventilate our houses, the way we get from A to B, that oil will cease to be as centrally important as it is in everyday life, not in industrial life and so on, but in everyday life as it is today.
Well, as you say, there may be a fundamental change in the way we live and more local markets and less of the sort of consumeristic world we've got used to, which is being fueled by this cheap oil. And as you mentioned at the beginning, the airline business is in trouble, and so we may sort of fly less and change the way we live. And I'm not saying this is some sort of doomsday scenario. With a bit of luck, we can figure out how to live very sensibly in the changed circumstances, but they definitely are changed.
Yeah. You and I, when we've spoken before on this program, the whole notion of oil, particularly, as a raw material for other very useful things, much more useful in its way than its use simply as a fuel for burning, for producing heat and CO2.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's there's hardly anything we use that doesn't have a certain oil component to it. And probably a greater priority should be given to these essential things than just... you look out of the window in any town and the thing is just choked with traffic burning up a finite resource. It's a bit of a strange way to live, in a way. But I think in positive signs, we see the Lewis in Dublin, for example, and I was just in Switzerland the other day, and they had a very efficient tram line system. Even in Basel, they are returning to the bicycle, apparently happy to use that to commute on. So I think it's a change of attitude and a change of behavior that will help solve the problem.
Tony, you don't quite see it, I don't think, this way, that because we are in this bubble at the moment, which will force ultimately prices down, that we're not going to give up oil anytime soon.
No, I would go along with a lot of what Mr. Campbell says about how conservation is going to be something that we take up and embrace. I mean, he just mentioned riding bicycles to work. But I would certainly take issue with the statement that peak oil is beyond the existence of peak oil or the imminence of peak oil is beyond dispute. It certainly isn't. Now, if you want to say philosophically, will there one time be a day when, after which, world oil production declines? Probably there is.
There has to be. Because, you know, if there is a finite resource and the globe is finite, there has to be at some point.
Philosophically, yes, yes.
Wait, may I interrupt?
No, because I haven't finished.
Make your point, Tony, yeah, and I'll go back to Colin.
My point is there are still massive, massive resources waiting to be developed, ones that we know about. Not to mention about the ones we don't know about, the unknown unknowns, to quote Mr. Rumsfeld. If you just take tar sands, there's double sitting there in tar sands of the existing trillion barrels that we think we have today. If you look at what we have today, the trillion barrels, that is all based on a recovery factor of something like 40%. In other words, 60% is being left behind, more than a trillion, which technology day by day finds cleverer ways of getting that 60% out. Then we could get on to the fact that oil is controlled these days not so much by the big wicked multinationals, but now by the national oil companies around the world. And the Seven Sisters used to be seven oil companies, and now it's seven national oil companies.
And in other words, national governments.
And what they are, there's Saudi Aramco, Gazprom in Russia, CNPC, the Chinese National Oil Company, NIOC, that's Iran, PDFSA, that's Venezuela, Petrobras, Brazil, and Petronas, Malaysia. They are the new Seven Sisters. They control 30% of the world's reserves compared to the oil companies' 3%. They produce 34% of the world's oil compared to the oil companies 10%. Now, that's one thing. Now, the second thing is that their technology is seriously constrained. Although they will tell you they use the best of technology, they do not, because they do not have the pressure to employ the latest and best technology, the way, in fact, commercial companies do, the need to squeeze the last barrel of oil out for a price that's a few dollars less, or a few cents in some cases, less than the oil price. And there's if you brought modern technology into these national oil companies, you would have a huge release of additional oil. Colin? I have no idea what that number is.
Colin?
So I don't accept peak oil is imminent by any means.
Colin?
Yeah, I think we have to distinguish different categories of oil. What I've been talking about is what I call regular conventional. That's what's produced most to date and will dominate most supply far into the future. By all means, there's huge amounts of tar sands left and oil shales, but the net energy return on producing that stuff is very low. It's very costly, and there are also some environmental negatives. So the peak of all discovery, of all regular oil anyway, was in the 60s. That's 40 years ago. So, and the whole world has been looked over, picked over, and also with an extraordinarily satisfactory economic regime where most of the cost of exploration was offset against taxable income in the past anyway. So I would say that the world has been very thoroughly explored. There are a few odd little corners like this extreme deep water thing off Brazil that you referred to. I think that's an anomalous situation. A once off, the world has plenty of deep water, but very little of it has the right geology. So I think that we've got to distinguish the different kinds of oil. Sure, we can produce more tar sands in the future, but at a very slow and costly rate.
If your point is that we have reached peak oil for easy oil, well, then I would agree, actually. Yes, the easy oil is being produced first, and oil is getting harder and harder to produce. Although technology makes steadily the hard oil easier. Mm.
We shouldn't forget, of course, that we have massive reserves of coal, which are fossil fuels. Now, there have to be ways of trapping the CO2 from the burning of coal and sulfurs and other things. But there is masses of ways of... Colin?
Well, as a matter of fact, we haven't mentioned it yet, but the public data on reserves of oil is grossly unreliable. I mean, the different databases show enormous different numbers.
And Tony's agreeing with you, by the way. He's nodding his head.
And so the oil reserves are very unreliable, publicly reported. But there's a new study being made in Germany, actually, which finds that the coal reserves have also been greatly exaggerated. So one's always assumed there was infinite amount of coal left, but this is now in question a little bit. And I gather that, you know, peak coal has happened in many countries. I don't know much about coal, really, but that seems to be the pressure.
That's a topic for another day, perhaps. Last words.
I don't know much about coal either, but the UK has used up something like 10% of its coal. The other 90% is still there. And of course, any coal you produce takes pressure off oil because it's another form of energy.
All right, last words then, gentlemen. For the listener, for example, in Mam Cross in Galway, it looks like that oil will forever rise. A listener's feeling the pain. It's 150.9 a litre in Mam Cross.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah.
When you're in a boom, by boom in this case I mean high oil price, it seems like it lasts forever. The minute it doesn't seem like it lasts forever, it stops and price comes down. And likewise, when you're in a bust and the oil price is low, it seems like it's forever. And I've lived and worked through a number of booms and busts in my life, and I remember a famous bumper sticker during the last bust, which was kind of the late 90s, and it said, "Oh Lord, please give us one more boom, and we promise not to piss it away this time."
On that note, thank you all for joining us, Colin Campbell and Tony Allwright.